The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Cancer of the GI tract, liver, and pancreas is presented by Dr. Jack Bragg.
GI oncology. Start with cancer of the stomach. Adenocarcinoma is far and away the most common type of cancer that we see in the stomach, followed by lymphoma. And you can see there's a couple or three other ones that occasionally will pop up. Carcinoid, we've talked about. I don't know if I've ever seen a squamous cell carcinoma, but at any rate, they start in the mucosa and then work their way down. This gives you a little bit of a feeling for the role of diet and environmental factors that probably contribute to the incidence of gastric cancer. It looks like if you're a female and you live in either Bombay, India, or the United States, you're at the least risk of all for gastric cancer. Or if you're a man in Japan, you're at the highest risk, and everybody else is kind of in between there someplace. It's thought that the dietary factor probably includes the conversion of dietary nitrates to nitrites and then to N-nitroso compounds of some sort. And along the way, that works as a carcinogen. Most cancers involve either the activation of an oncogene or several oncogenes and the stopping of the functioning of tumor suppressor genes of some sort, and that probably goes with gastric cancer as well. The end result is usually adenocarcinoma. Here's some of your, I just mentioned oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. This is a diagram of the way this may shake out once the dietary part of things has taken place. Then the oncogene is activated and you end up again with gastric cancer. How does it present? If there's early perineal and perineural invasion, they may present with pain. Makes sense. If there's diaphragmatic invasion from a tumor in the superior part of the stomach, the fundus, they may present with chronic hiccups. They can present with GI bleeding, early satiety, weight loss, those types of things. Maybe one of those, maybe several of them. Here's what it looks like on an upper GI x-ray. This is the tumor here that's not taking any contrast. This is it on an endoscopic exam. Endoscopic and x-ray here. These days, most of them are diagnosed endoscopically because you can do biopsies at the same time, make a diagnosis that way. In spite of all the recent advances in chemotherapy and treatment, cancer of the esophagus, gastric cancer, and pancreas cancer have made very little progress over the last few years in extending survival. 5-year survival for all of these is still very low, right around 10%. Catching them early enough to do surgery is the only way, basically, to give somebody a cure. Pancreatic tumors arise from the many cellular elements. Remember, there are not only ductal cells, there is an exocrine pancreas and an endocrine pancreas as well. Again, adenocarcinoma is the big player. I talked in a previous lecture about cyst adenocarcinoma and some of the cystic malignancies that you may run into. Islet cell tumors, we'll talk a little more about them and give you a little bit of a feel for what you might see on the boards. Epidemiologic associations, not too strong. Males a little more than females, black a little more than whites, urban a little more than rural, tobacco, alcohol, diet. Chronic pancreatitis should be off of this list because, as I told you a while ago in the pancreas lecture, there's a 3 to 15 times greater incidence of cancer in chronic pancreatitis than people with no pancreatitis. But these other things, tobacco, alcohol, diet, diabetes, maybe a slight association, but there's not enough strength to say that they cause cancer. The symptoms depend on where the tumor is. And oddly enough, a tumor in the head of the pancreas causes symptoms a little earlier and is actually a little more likely to be cured surgically than a tumor in the body or the tail, because tumors in the body or the tail don't present with symptoms as early as tumors in the head of the pancreas do. So they're more advanced in the body and tail by the time they're diagnosed, and they usually present with pain and weight loss as opposed to jaundice when they're located in the body and or the tail of the pancreas. Again, the anatomic location of the pancreas makes diagnosis difficult and facilitates early dissemination. Remember, there's no serosa around the pancreas, so malignancy doesn't have any difficulty extending itself either directly or via lymphatic spread or spread via the vascular system. A couple of different ways to diagnose. On the left-hand side there, you can see radiologists putting a needle into the pancreas there. And on the other picture is an abnormal ERCP. It's difficult to tell exactly what you're looking at there. I think this is the common bile duct here, and there's really, you don't see much of a pancreatic duct on that slide. Now there has to be some thought go into doing a biopsy of a pancreas. There's some, if you have metastatic disease already, it's not a big deal to do a biopsy. If you think you have a localized tumor, you have to consider the possibility of seeding the tumor if you stick a needle in it and bringing tumor cells out through the needle tract. So it kind of depends on the stage of the disease as to whether or not you stick a needle in it. The other way that they'll sometimes do it at our institution is do an EUS and do a fine needle biopsy. Fine needle biopsies tend to not get as many cells, and sometimes they're not successful, but if you can, it's a safe way to be able to make a diagnosis and get some cells. May spread, as I mentioned earlier, through various different ways that are available to the pancreas. Direct spread is probably the most significant. Pancreatic islet cell tumors, there's several different types of these because there's several different types of endocrine cells in the pancreas. A, D, and B cells, as well as a couple of others that may cause tumors to form and give particular symptoms. And here's the types of symptoms that these various endocrine cells may produce if a tumor develops. With glucagonoma, for instance, because glucagon is manufactured at a much higher rate than normal, diabetes and a rash may be the cause. Insulinomas, obviously, hypoglycemia is a big problem because the tumor is producing insulin. These others, gastrinoma is probably the most common one on this list. VIPoma has an incidence of about 1 in 1 million, so it's the kind of thing that most people don't even see once in a lifetime. And then there's some non-functioning islet cell tumors that have mass effect, but since they're not producing anything, they don't cause any significant symptoms. Hereditary colon cancers. About 20% of all colon cancers have a specifically identifiable hereditary component. Now, all colon cancers have some genetic component, but about 20% have a specifically diagnosable type of inherited malignancy. The two most common are familial adenomatous polyposis that is associated with the APC gene and hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer that is associated with mismatch repair gene abnormalities. Now, the HNPCC used to be called Lynch syndrome after Henry Lynch. There was a Lynch 1 and a Lynch 2. They've been combined now into HNPCC to make life a little easier for everybody. Familial adenomatous polyposis that is caused by the mutation in the APC gene. You usually have hundreds to thousands of adenomatous polyps. It looks like this on this resected piece of colon. And there's nearly 100% risk of colorectal cancer without a colectomy. Mean age of diagnosis is about 39 years. There's also an attenuated type of FAP where instead of hundreds to thousands, you just have up to 100 adenomatous polyps in the colon. Obviously a little bit less severe. The onset of malignancy is a little later in life, but it still leads to a malignancy, a colorectal cancer, most of the time. This is what it looks like, FAP, endoscopically. As well as the colon, you may also have polyps in other areas of the GI tract that you can see here. That's why when we have a patient that has FAP, they also get upper endoscopies on a regular basis as well as colonoscopy until they have their colon taken out. Extraintestinal features that you may see, these make great board questions. CHRPE, very unusual, doesn't occur very often at all. Abnormal dentition, epidermal cysts, desmoid tumors, osteomas, thyroid tumors, and occasionally brain tumors. Those are all potential components to FAP. HNPCC is caused, as I mentioned earlier, by a mutation in any one of five mismatch repair genes. The recommendation now is that everybody who is diagnosed with colorectal cancer is tested for these mismatch repair genes because it looks like it's more common than what we thought it was in the past. You may think, well, I don't have a relative with colon cancer, so how could I have this? Well, that individual could be the index case. 70 to 80% of lifetime risk of developing CRC along with some other malignancies. Average age at diagnosis of colon cancer, 44 years of age. Multiple colon cancers, proximal, right-sided cancers are more common compared with cancer in the general population. Other cancers can occur as well, genitourinary, endometrial, ovarian, uterine, renal pelvis, gastric, small bowel, and pancreatic cancers are all possibilities. A little more on HNPCC. Few or no adenomas, unlike sporadic colon cancer. It's an autosomal dominant phenomenon, and in females especially have a higher risk of other malignancies. As I mentioned earlier, uterus and ovarian, especially endometrial. Now there's two types of criteria that you may be asked about in order to see if you have a patient that fits the description family-wise of having HNPCC. This one I'm showing you is called the Amsterdam criteria. There's also one called the Bethesda criteria. And somebody has combined the two, I think, to come up with yet a third classification system. I don't know that you need to know these. You might be asked just in general what might be used in order to see if somebody likely has HNPCC. And if Amsterdam criteria is one of the choices, that's what I would go with. But it was an attempt, this one and the Bethesda criteria, an attempt to see if via family history, we could come up with a way to determine whether or not people actually had HNPCC. The genetics of it anymore, though, today, that you get right from the tumor itself when it's biopsied or resected, tells us for the most part what we need to know about which genes are involved, whether it's the mismatch repair genes or otherwise. Some extra colonic features of FAP and HNPCC, these are similar, but they're not quite the same. You can see there the differences in the extra colonic cancers in both of them, as well as other lesions that show up. Most of these we've talked about, I think. This slide just shows you the relationship genetically of sporadic colon cancer that 80% of Americans who get colon cancer get, average risk patients, and the ones who have FAP or HNPCC, the genetic involvement is more the higher you go on this bar here up to the inherited syndromes versus the sporadic cancers. Almost all colon malignancies arise from the mucosal epithelial cells. Again, we're dealing most of the time, 98% of the time, with adenocarcinoma. You'll occasionally see a sarcoma. Occasionally, you'll see a melanoma. In fact, I'll show you a metastatic melanoma in the colon. But they always arise in the epithelium, and that's why when I talk about polyps here, you can understand why we can cure this before it ever becomes not localized to the colon because it starts in the epithelium rather than deeper in. On the left is what normal colonic tissue looks like. benign adenoma in the middle, and the chaos on the right side is invasive carcinoma. Risk factors. The biggest risk factor of all is age. Average risk patients, once they hit 50, their risk begins to increase. That's why we recommend starting yearly every 10-year colonoscopies at the age of 50. Prior personal history of colorectal adenoma or colorectal carcinoma ups your risk. Family history of CRC, especially first-degree relatives, and especially anybody under the age of 60, increases your risk. Inflammatory bowel disease, I talked about earlier. Potential environmental factors, high fat, low fiber consumption, beer and ale consumption, especially in rectal cancer, low dietary selenium, environmental carcinogens and mutagens, sort of like what we talked about with gastric cancer. It's unsettled yet as far as how big of a role, if any, these play. But there does seem to be somewhat of an association with some of these factors and colorectal carcinoma. But I would not advise patients to eliminate all red meat from their diet or all alcohol or try to exclude all the selenium. It's just not worth it. It's probably not going to be that helpful. Diagnostic modalities. The professional societies change this information all the time. What you probably will see on the boards is still the air contrast barium colon, probably combined with a sigmoidoscopy as well as colonoscopy. Today we also have colonography, which is a modification software on CT scanning. I think the other thing to be aware of, fecal occult blood testing is still recommended by the professional societies, only it's not with the old GWIAC cards, it's with the newer immunohistochemical cards. They're much more sensitive and specific. DNA testing is available. I don't know how good that is yet, and you probably won't see that on the boards, but if you're asked, colonoscopy is still the best screening tool because you can also not only find the malignancy, you can biopsy it and make a diagnosis at the same time. Predisposing conditions, we've looked at these already. The vast majority are average risk or unknown. The adenocarcinoma sequence that you've probably heard talked about means that most, other than HNPCC, most adenocarcinomas begin with adenomatous polyps. There is a gradual progression, which includes genetic changes that I mentioned earlier, tumor suppressor genes and oncogenes, that gradually leads to low-grade dysplasia, high-grade dysplasia, and then malignancy. This shows the same thing to you in a little different way. Down at the bottom, you see, in addition to the oncogenes, some of the other genetic abnormalities that occur along the way. Polyps have a wide variety of the way they look. The left-hand side of the screen, you see a pedunculated polyp. Most of them don't have that big of a stalk, but they do kind of look that way. Those are easy to take out with a hot snare. On the right, you see a villous adenoma, which is what we call a sessile polyp. It's flat, doesn't have a stalk, and those are harder to get rid of. They usually have to be taken out with endoscopic mucosal resection or surgery. Polyps are described in two different ways. Histology, which is either adenomatous, tubulovillous, or villous, and the risk of malignancy goes up from adenomatous to tubulovillous to villous. And size is also important. The larger a polyp is, the more likely you're going to find dysplasia of some sort. Now, the thing to pay attention to here, and this will come up again, is the muscularis mucosa that you see here. If a polyp has malignancy in it and it's taken out and the pathologist examines it and the high-grade dysplasia or the cancer is entirely above the muscularis mucosa, then your patient has a cure. That was a malignant polyp and the patient is cured of their disease. If the pathologist says, I can't tell if the cancer extends down below the muscularis mucosa or the pathologist says it has extended below the muscularis mucosa, you've got invasive cancer and that patient needs a resection.
So that could easily be a scenario that you're given on the boards as far as what decisions you make based on what the pathologist tells you about where the cancer is located. These are some other types of polyps. Now again, these are the important ones, tubular adenoma, tubulovillus, and villus. Those are the ones with the most malignant potential and the ones you need to know when you're talking about colorectal cancer. Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, hamartomatous polyps, is an interesting syndrome. It's rare. I've got a picture or two of what people look like that have Peutz-Jeghers, and you might see something like that on the boards. Hyperplastic polyps down at the bottom, as well as lipomas, are completely benign for the most part. Now, there is a hyperplastic polyp syndrome. I've never seen a case of it, but occasionally you'll see a case of hyperplastic polyp syndrome that does have some malignant potential. But 99.9% of the hyperplastic polyps removed from a colon are benign. Colorectal cancer and adenomatous polyps have a similar anatomic distribution. That was the first key that anybody had, that adenomas eventually may lead to malignancy. We were finding, and I say we, it was before my time, they were finding malignancies in the same places that they were finding adenomas. And that started people to thinking. This is what I mentioned just a little while ago. This is what the pathology looks like on an in situ carcinoma that's confined above the muscularis mucosa on the left and invasive carcinoma that you see there on the right. Cuthbert Duke was a surgeon back in the 30s that was trying to find a way to classify colon cancer in order to know how best to treat it. So he came up with this classification system. It's been modified a couple of times since Duke first described it, but it's still around, and this is what it looks like. You can see Duke's A, B1, B2, C1, and C2. Duke's D means metastatic disease. And the next couple of slides just show you in a little different way what that involves. This next one compares it with the TNM system. On the right, you see the modified Duke's classification system, and you see the TNM system there in the middle. And you can compare the two and see how the two compare one to another. CEA, we get a question periodically about screening with CEA, carcinoembryonic antigen. It's a terrible screening tool. Where it's of some value is if the CEA is elevated at the time of diagnosis, then you can use the CEA to follow that individual after they go to surgery. Once they go to surgery, the CEA should come back down pretty close to normal, and then you can check it periodically. If it begins to go back up, that individual probably has a recurrence. If the CEA is normal at the time of diagnosis, it's not going to help you do anything. No reason to follow it after that. But you can't use it to screen. It's not reliable enough. Cronkite Canada syndrome. I threw in a couple of these other syndromes. It would be a lecture in itself to talk about all of these various syndromes that you can run into. I threw in a couple of them just to make you aware that these are a couple of things that you could see. Cronkite Canada syndrome has a very low incidence. Doesn't happen very often at all. I've never seen a case of it, but these are some of the findings that you may run into. Peutz-Jeghers, I mentioned earlier. Left upper picture there is a picture of the freckles on the buccal mucosa and the inside of the lip of somebody that has Peutz-Jeghers syndrome. You can see some of the other characteristics there on the right. And I think I have, one more picture of a young lady with freckles on her lips. When you see that, you think Peutz-Jeghers syndrome. If you're shown this picture or one like this on the exam and you're asked what the diagnosis is, now you know. Carcinoids can occur in the appendix, the rectum, or the ileum. You can see the numbers there about what's most common. Most of the time, appendiceal carcinoids are just an incidental finding. Somebody has their appendix taken out for whatever reason, appendicitis usually, and a pathologist finds a carcinoid, and there's nothing usually that you need to do about it. But you can also find them in the rectum, and occasionally we will do a colonoscopy on somebody and put a scope in the terminal ileum and find a carcinoid. They may be indolent. They may not be active at all. They may not be causing any problems. Sometimes it's just an incidental diagnosis. When they do cause problems, though, is when they produce 5-hydroxytryptophan, serotonin, or some of these compounds that cause the various symptoms that I'm going to show you here. Size is also important with a carcinoid. The bigger they are, just like adenomatous polyps, the more risk of malignancy. Carcinoid flush that we all learned about in medical school is largely a product of bradykinin. You get vasodilatation and some of the other symptoms that may go along with it. Paroxysmal flush, valvular heart disease, which if I remember correctly is the tricuspid valve, wheezing, dermatitis, diarrhea, and malabsorption. Liver tumors. Three basic ways cancer affects the liver. One is if the liver cells themselves, the hepatocytes, are the origin of the malignancy, then we have a hepatoma or hepatocellular carcinoma. If the malignancy arises in the biliary tree, we call it cholangiocarcinoma. If the liver is the site of metastasis from breast, lung, pancreas, or any other place, obviously we just refer to it as it's metastatic to the liver. Any of those are possibilities. Hepatocellular carcinoma spreads through a variety of routes. There's a rich blood supply, rich lymphatics. It isn't difficult for this tumor to spread at all. Hepatocellular carcinoma almost always arises in a cirrhotic liver, and it doesn't matter what caused the cirrhosis, whether it's Hep C, Catherine talked about, alcoholic cirrhosis, hemochromatosis, it doesn't make any difference what caused the cirrhosis. Just having it puts the patient at risk for hepatocellular carcinoma, and there's a protocol for following people with cirrhosis to try and get a jump on any hepatocellular carcinoma that may develop. It usually involves imaging and following, what's the name of that blood test? But any of these diseases that you see there may lead to cirrhosis. Incidence of hepatitis B, where there's a lot of hepatitis B, a lot of hepatitis C, there's a lot of hepatocellular carcinoma. The red areas here are where hepatitis B is epidemic, and it's also where hepatocellular carcinoma is found more than any place else. This is a list of, some of you may never have heard of some of these things. Methotrexate is a fairly common drug everybody probably knows about. Thorotrast is an interesting substance. Thorotrast was one of the first contrast mediums that radiologists used when they did GI x-rays. The only problem with it was it caused cancer in many of the people that it was used on. So obviously it was discontinued as any kind of a contrast medium, but there were several people that developed various types of hepatic tumors as a result of the use of Thorotrast. Metastatic cancer can cause jaundice, and usually it can be from obstructing the biliary tree, but it's oftentimes because of massive replacement of liver cells, liver tissue with tumor. You can see metastasis from the colon, the pancreas, the stomach, breast, lung, occasionally unknown primary. It's not unusual to have a patient with metastatic disease to the liver and nobody knows where the primary is. So we see them and do upper and lower endoscopy, trying to find a source, and they're evaluated in several other ways. Sometimes they find a primary and sometimes they don't. This slide looks like, this is a colonoscope that's retroflexed in the rectum, and a lot of people would think that what you're seeing there is probably hemorrhoids, but this is actually, that's a metastatic melanoma that you're seeing right there, which leads into discussion of anal cancer. Anal cancer is epidermoid predominantly. It's probably secondary to infection with papillomavirus and has some association with poor hygiene. Spreads to inguinal nodes, more of a problem in men usually than women. This is what it looks like. At the bottom there you see the colonoscope. Again, it's retroflexed looking back. This is the cancer here, colonoscope. And cancer. It's a bad actor. It's difficult to treat.